Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Chuck Wowrod, Vice President of Standards Activities, Board of Governors, IEEE CS. Chuck, you are so busy, and you've got such a heavy schedule and an amazing background, and I really appreciate you coming in today to do this interview and sharing your experiences with the audience.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. I'm happy to do it.
Now, Chuck, you're a longtime leader within the IEEE CS, and as I mentioned, just an amazing history of contribution. Can you share with us your leadership lessons?
Yes. I think that for me, I don't really concentrate on leadership so much as I concentrate on the mission, the task at hand, the purpose and its importance. And when you're able to communicate to other people the importance of what it is you're trying to accomplish, then you surprisingly just get a whole lot of people falling into line and doing whatever they can to help.
Now, can you tell us more about the IEEE CS organization and why IT professionals should get involved?
Yes. The IEEE is often, or has in the past, often been thought of as electronics and electrical engineers, but we, quite a few years ago now, changed the designation to strictly IEEE, and that's because so many of our members are computing professionals. In fact, the computer society within the IEEE is the largest of all the technical societies. Altogether, there are 36 technical societies, but ours makes up almost a quarter of the entire global IEEE. And IT people are an important part of the computing profession. They are, in many ways, the most important part because they're the people who bring the technology and the knowledge and the services that they provide to people who need them. And increasingly, the world relies on information technology.
Now, before I move on and talk about some of your business roles, because you've got a remarkable business history as well and an industry history, can you just share some of the roles that you have within the IEEE organization and just maybe overview some of your work?
Oh, sure. Actually, I got started because I care about standards and standards in the software world. I found when I was consulting with IBM in the 1990s that a lot of the problems that stem from having, for example, they're often in software development organizations and software product companies. People who are very technically savvy but end up being kind of like prima donnas, or there may be battling egos. And so just being able to introduce an existing standard that had been created by a bunch of really good minds working together globally was able to get them to focus on, okay, you know, this is what the industry has agreed on as a standard. How does this work for you guys? So I first got involved with software standards, did that for several years, and then got involved with the one of the other program boards. We actually, within the Computer Society, have six program boards. And my next move was from the standards one to the technical and conference activities. The Computer Society has hundreds of conferences that it puts on every year, and behind those are bunches of expert technical people. So it turns out that once upon a time, the technical committees under the TNC board had included the standards committees. So they'd been together, the technical expertise people and the standards people. But they got separated, something like, I don't know, maybe 15, maybe 20 years ago, for various reasons. But anyway, so there was clearly a need to bring those people back together and bridge that gap. So that's why I got involved there. Then, let's see, I got drafted back into standards, the standards activities VP, and in the meantime was elected to the Board of Governors. And that's pretty much, I know I've been involved in other program boards, but those are the two ones that have really occupied my time and my interest.
Well, just a remarkable history of contribution, and especially with one of the most famous and predominant computing societies and, in fact, technical societies in the world today. So we're now going to move on to some of your business roles. So in each of your business roles, past or present, can you describe some major challenges you faced and then your solutions to the challenges that would be of value to our audience?
Yes, starting out as a technical person, I sort of expected that people would always in technical environments behave rationally and logically, and that emotions wouldn't be involved. Well, I was young and I was wrong. It turns out that so many of the problems that we have in getting projects done and projects successful has to do with interactions between people. A tool that I discovered back in the early 80s or mid 80s was the Myers-Briggs type indicators. And as a consultant going into new organizations, it was a very handy tool because it turns out that it's not quite like people, you know, are interested in hearing about themselves. And so when you get them to agree to participate in this exercise with the Myers-Briggs test, they feel that they're learning something about themselves. And they do. But most important, they learn something about the fact that other people may think differently than they do, may assess a situation differently than they do. And so it provides a platform for people to get better at communicating with each other. So I found that just tremendously helpful, both when I was managing engineering groups and then later as a consultant when I would go in and consult on software engineering and how to make projects more successful. The other thing goes back to standards, which is if you can involve the people who are going to be using group processes in defining those group processes, then you're much more likely to get acceptance and enthusiasm about any new processes. And that, as I mentioned earlier, that's an area where having existing standards can help, not because you're laying it on them as this is what you have to do, but as the product of a bunch of good minds, and then engage your group's minds and, okay, can we use this? Is it applicable? Is it tailorable? But, you know, make them get engaged in defining how they're going to get their work done most effectively and most comfortably.
Now, we're going to sort of get into more of a broader discussion now in this question. You know, what do you see as some future disruptive innovations that business executives should be watching for?
I think that we're in the middle of two of them right now. One is the shift to mobile. I think that's going to have a tremendous impact on us, and that's also what makes the whole security issue so big and so iffy. It's not as if we, back in the old days when we had the old glass house with the mainframes and we could control things, we don't have that now. We have thousands of variables, many of which we haven't even begun to understand. And then that, of course, relates directly to the emergence of the cloud as the platform of choice. So we've got all these mobile devices, this whole move towards bring your own device, BYOD, and this trust in the cloud. And I think that that is what presents IT organizations today and the enterprises they serve with a tremendous challenge.
Chuck, earlier you mentioned that, you know, you are an active consultant, you have a consulting business. In fact, you're much sought after because of all the expertise you have in so many domains. So in your current consulting role, what are some best practices that you are sharing with your clients?
I think that the as I've said, you know, just a little while ago, the primary things that we have to deal with are the interpersonal communications, the communications down through the organization, and also the communication up, which often doesn't happen very well. Not to mention the communication that needs to happen across the enterprise. And all of these are essential to IT, but IT hasn't had, it does not include in its educational programs how to do this kind of communication. So being able to speak their language when I go in, having had a wide range of technical problems and solutions in my background, enables me to talk their language, but also to use it to explain how they've got to communicate and how they can do it successfully.
Now, I know you're part of this work on sort of a international body of knowledge for ICT or for at least for computing and technology. Are you incorporating then what you just mentioned, sort of some of the communication interpersonal elements as part of that?
That'll be part of it. I'm leading an effort within the IEEE to put together a body of knowledge for IT. We started back in 1998 with the body of knowledge. Actually, it's a guide to the body of knowledge for software engineering. The reason I make the distinction between the body of knowledge and the guide to the body of knowledge is that the body of knowledge is actually intangible. It's out there across the globe in people's minds. It's what people know, especially the best people know, about how to do IT well. And so what we want to do is to have a book that, and remember, it's only one book. It's not shelves of books. That's why it's a guide. It gives a broad idea of what enterprise IT encompasses, and then we'll point to specialized box. Like there's a data management box, there's a business analysis box, there are various other really good sources of information. And we can also point to the curricula that exist. We are working with the ACM in trying to make sure that we have consistency between the computing curricula and the IT box. We're also working on developing an IT competency model that will accommodate the fact that people in IT can move across from one area to another rather than it being a straightly vertical path. Like there are people who, well, back for example, when I was a director of engineering at Ingress, people would start out, very good, technically savvy people would start out in technical support and then would move over to developing automated testing because they knew from a customer point of view the sensitive parts of the Ingress relational database management system. And then from that, they might move into development. So the same thing happens in IT. You move across the organization rather than just developing more and more expertise within your vertical. So we want to be able to have a competency model that enables that kind of movement across the organization. And between the BOC and the competency model, we want to give people a better idea as to both those that are already within IT, but those who might go into it, about what all the opportunities are. There's a very wide range of opportunities.
No, that's really interesting. I guess, you know, I know that you're based out of the U.S., and the U.S. is such a dominant force worldwide, you know, with a $14, $15 trillion economy. What are some of the international aspects? Like, are you reaching out to international communities to get their ideas as you formulate or do this work on the BOC?
Oh, very much so. The IEEE is a global organization, and it's important for us, even though if we're leading an effort out of the U.S., that we reach out and include people in all other parts of the world, too. In fact, for standards, we just offered a call for participation for two new standards in environmental assessment of electronics products. And we're just about to form the working groups, and we've got people from Pakistan, from India, from a couple of countries in Africa, from Thailand, from China, from Korea, from all over. So it's a challenge because we need to accommodate communication and time zones and things like that. But we do it. We bring people together. We provide a platform, and we can end up taking longer because we have to accommodate the time differences and the language differences. But it makes a really good product that way. And also, Stephen, as I think you know, we have reached out to KIPS, to the Australian Computer Society, and to other computer societies to help us with the IT BOC. And so there's active participation, as I think you know, from KIPS.
So I just should mention for the audience, because this interview goes globally, that KIPS is the Canadian Information Processing Society. It's Canada's sort of national society with regards to IT professionals.
Yes. Good. Oh, and one of the things I wanted to point out was when we were doing the major update on the software configuration management standard, we broadened it and made it an inclusive configuration management standard, so it covers hardware projects that are software intensive and software projects, and addresses systems engineering and configuration management too. But anyway, one of our best contributors there was a guy from Argentina.
Chuck, I know you're also involved with this organization called FIPO, the Federation of Enterprise Architecture Professional Organizations. Now, can you tell us more about FIPO and why businesses and organizations should get involved?
Yes. Dr. Brian Cameron at Penn State was the prime mover behind getting this together, and we were really glad to see his efforts and Penn State's efforts in this area, because for the past 20-plus years, there's been recognition of the need for something like what we're now, what we call enterprise architecture. We've had, business process reengineering. We've had the balanced scorecard. In IBM, we had, a large consulting offering called transition management. But all of these things addressed integration of IT services, into the body of the organization. And enterprise architecture is pulling all of these things together. We know from studies that have been done that successfully applied enterprise architecture does wonders for an enterprise. But the problem is people have not, there has not been congruence on the definition of enterprise architecture, of whether it resides within IT only or whether it belongs outside outside of IT but includes IT. And that's what FIPO is addressing. We need a common definition of what enterprise architecture is and its scope in order to then also define the applicable methods and techniques.
Now, every time enterprise architecture is sort of mentioned in one of the LinkedIn forums or you see a blog on it, there's also some controversy and there's a lot of sort of discussion. So what are some of the barriers to enterprise architecture adoption in enterprises, and how can they be overcome?
Well, it's actually, there's a really good paper that Dr. James LaPalme wrote about 18 months ago, and it shows that there's a distinction of the current thinking between basically three different camps. And so what we want to do is try to show that there's a range and people can choose for their organizations, their enterprises, where in that range they fall. And so then they can be clear about what it is they're trying to achieve. The other challenge there, directly related, is, again, body of knowledge. Depending on the scope of the enterprise architecture endeavor, you need varying scopes of the knowledge that you apply. So one of the things we're also doing within the IEEE Computer Society is working with MITRE to transition the enterprise architecture body of knowledge that they developed but haven't worked on since 2004 to the public. And we've formed a consortium to govern the further development of that EABOC and to help guide its use by the public. And we are now actively soliciting people who are well-respected in enterprise architecture to submit their past publications and to submit new publications.
Now, earlier you mentioned this paper that you thought was quite a good paper. Is that available through your digital library?
It was published in IT Pro. And so, yes, the answer is yes. We're also posting it in the EABOC website repository, but that's not going to be made public until this fall.
So I should mention that IT Pro is a publication of the IEEE CS. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you very much for pointing that out.
Now, Chuck, you get around in that you're globally recognized. You have an incredible history both on the standard side and defining, you know, how the industry is going to move forward, but also as a professional, working in business and so on. And as a result, you must come across some controversy. Can you describe some areas of controversy in the areas of ICT or IT?
Yes, actually. I don't know if you're familiar with Bob Lewis. He writes a column for InfoWorld, has for many years. He's a staunch advocate of IT. But one of the discussions we have, Bob and I, is about IT as a trade or IT as a profession. And that's something that the Australian Computer Society started addressing several years ago, the British Computer Society. And the key thing here is, can you be an effective IT professional without a degree in computer science? And many of us feel the answer is yes. Maybe you have a degree in software engineering. Maybe you have a degree. Maybe you came out of electrical engineering. But there's a body, a part of the body of knowledge of IT that is not going to come from our traditional educational programs now. And we also have currently in IT a lot of people who don't necessarily have four-year college degrees. They may only have two-year community college degrees, or they may have gone to technical colleges. They may have, you know, learned on the job and simply acquired a bunch of certifications. And we need a way to provide for all of these people to be recognized for what they can do. So one of the things that, to make a long answer short, one of the things that we wonder about is certifications. There are tons of certifications today that come from vendors. So you can get certified in language, you can get certified in tool. But are there more meaningful certifications that would be universal, that would address fundamental principles of IT, rather than just how to use a specific tool? So I think that's a big issue.
Well, that's a natural segue into my next question. And
oh, good.
And that is, do you feel computing should be a recognized profession on par with things like accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a recognized code of ethics, and a discipline process for those who breach it, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
Yes, I definitely do. And I think that there are several organizations outside of the IEEE that feel the same way. I know that IP3 and GITCA are also concerned with these things. One of the things that we've done as we reach out to these other organizations that have the same concerns and desires that we do is put together a model of a profession. And so we use that to address, okay, for an IT profession, what elements are needed? And in order to figure this out, we did a study back in the mid-90s of the classic professions and how it is that over time they all evolved to developing the same elements. So our model that's actually available on the IEEE Computer Society's website under the Professional Activities Board-IT, the model of a profession shows what we are working towards and the elements that indeed some of them exist. So we're just, that already exist and people have been sort of feeling their way towards. So we're just trying to pull them together into a model so that we can accelerate both the development of the elements and the professional recognition that we think people in computing and in the IT part of computing deserve.
Brings to mind this idea that, you know, the principles and practice exam, or something called the PE exam for software engineering, has been released, and sort of the critical mass of 10 U.S. states have agreed to support this exam and this whole idea of software engineering being sort of with recognized credentialing and so on. What are your feelings about that?
I think it is a difficult area. A lot of things that you might not think would be influenced by that move are, for example, in some states, if you have a professional engineer's designation, then it has direct impact on how much you pay and what kind of insurance you need. So the experience of getting the engineering license can then cause a huge jump in the amount that you have to pay for liability insurance. Whether or not everybody who practices software engineering should have to be licensed is another question, you know, or should it only be for safety critical systems like in atomic energy plants? So there's just a whole bunch of difficult questions there.
And just for the benefit of the audience, I should mention that this kind of licensing structure would be you go to an accredited university or college where they have a four-year program, or where you get a degree in software engineering. You would have to write a fundamentals exam upon graduation, and then you would get 4+ years, or to say 6 years, of professional practice experience, and then you could write this principles and practice exam or PE exam, at which point you are then certified and licensed to to practice. Did I miss anything in that overview?
No, I think that's right. I think it's important to point out that we have professional engineers who are licensed by states, but we have similar things for other types of professions. For example, teachers are certified. When you go through and get your four-year degree, you also apply for your teacher certification, and then I think you've got two years after that to get a master's and then get full certification. So it's the engineering route is not the only route in professions, and we need to take that into account too. So maybe the ones that exist for electrical engineers aren't always the best path for people within computing.
Now, Chuck, you do travel extensively. You speak extensively because of your fame, in essence, and all the work that you've done in the past and continue to do. Do you have any stories you want to share, maybe something really amusing or interesting, surprising, unexpected?
Oh, yes. Immediately comes to mind the story of one of my clients in Japan. Several years ago, I used to go over several times a year, and I'd always make time after the engagement with the client to visit wider areas in Japan. So one time, I got to go to Nara, the ancient capital of Japan. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, and has great temple grounds. And two funny things happened there. One was, when I was going to the temple grounds, I was dressed all in white. Just because it was that time of year, summer, et cetera. And I was really eager to see the deer that I'd heard about that just wander freely around the grounds. And so I get into the temple area, and sure enough, there are all these darling little deer. And then I see there's a vendor selling deer food. So I have to get some. And I'm thinking, I need to entice them to come visit me. So I get the food, and I put it in my hand, out of the bag. And immediately, all of these deer start just assembling around me, and they get closer and closer. So by the time I finished feeding them, my white pants were brown. It was like I had no clue. They were trying to eat me, too. They kept thinking that in my pockets there must be more food. So that was one memorable thing from Japan. The other one was also in Nara. As you know, Stephen, I'm tall. And in Nara, the ancient capital, there are a lot of elderly people visiting the shrines, and they tend to be pretty short. So they would come up, a little above my waist, that short. And this one lady, you wouldn't expect this because generally we think of Japanese as being so polite and so reserved, but sometimes they can't help themselves. So this one cute little lady, she was still standing up, straight and that sort of thing, but she was probably 70. She tugged on my shirt, and she said, "Excuse me, but are those your legs, your real legs?" She just couldn't believe that anybody could have legs that long.
Well, it's lucky I put my, it just makes me smile. That's just such a good story.
Thank you.
Now, this last question is very open-ended, and I sort of turned the tables in that if you were conducting this interview, what three questions would you ask, or one or two, and then what would be your answers?
I've never tried looking at myself from the outside in. I guess it would probably be something about being a woman in engineering, and what that's been like. Because certainly when I started, I started programming in 1968. There just were not women in computing. There were very, very few. And it helped in many ways, I think. Before I got to meet people, my name's Chuck. It's actually was my nickname. Now it's my formal middle name. But so that I could correspond with people, and they would think I was a man, and so they could develop some idea of, intellect or whatever. But then when, in those days, we weren't Skyping. We were, depending on letters and things like that. Then they'd meet me in person and realize, oops, not a man. She is a woman. But she's already a friend, so I guess it must be okay. Anyway, I've been very glad to see, back in the 80s, there was a big rise in the participation of women in computer science. That has unfortunately tapered off, but now I'm seeing it rise again. And I'm delighted to see that because it's such a rewarding profession. It's so mentally engaging. It's fun. You get to work with really bright people. you know, we just need the encouragement to women to make them realize they can be welcome. And in many cases, they are. In other cases, because in IT especially, we tend to have, shyness, maybe, tend to work alone, be lone wolves, whatever. That can make it a little more difficult to admit strangers into the midst. But yeah, that would be it, the question about women in computing.
Well, that actually triggers another thought, and that is, I know that there's been a lot of overt bias against women over the years, and that kind of transition to maybe unconscious bias. And do you still see some of that today, that sort of unconscious bias? People don't even realize that there's this bias?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely do. It really is changing, though. The younger generation is a lot better about this. So I'm pleased to see that. But you do see subtle distinctions. I've seen it in meetings where a woman offers a suggestion and solution to a problem, and nobody picks up on it. It just dies there on the table, writhing miserably. And then a few minutes later, a guy presents the same idea, and then it's taken up. It's discussed and adopted. And I don't think people realize what they're doing when they do that. On the other hand, if a woman, in the same vein, when that same woman then tries to not let her idea die writhing miserably on the table, she's seen as too aggressive, is trying to be too domineering. So in the past generation, it's been kind of a can't-win situation. But as I said, I do see that changing.
Now, you're particularly famous in both the, nonprofit world and trade organizations, and sort of because your work with the IEEE, IEEE CS, and then, of course, in your business work as well. Do you see ways that you can make additional contributions as your life continues to evolve?
My goodness. Well, first of all, I don't think I'm famous, but thank you, Stephen. I don't really know. I mean, I've been mostly retired for a couple of years and been I work almost full time now for the IEEE, but as a volunteer. There are always new opportunities within the IEEE because, as I said, we are global. We are so large. I'm really interested in seeing how we can help in developing nations. And so that might be something after, the current standards work and the current IT BOC work and IT competency model work is well on its way.
Well, it's been a fascinating dialogue with you, and I do appreciate you coming in. I know your schedule is really, really demanding. We've had a hard time to get you situated for 40 minutes to an hour to sit down and do this interview, so I really do appreciate you sharing your deep experiences with the audience.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. I really enjoyed talking with you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Chuck Wowrad, Vice President of Standards Activities, Board of Governors, IEEE CS.